Elaine DiCicco is being interviewed by Renee Garalick for Concord's Oral History Program. The interview is taking place on December 11, 1998, at Concord Carlisle High School, where Ms. DiCicco has been principal for the last 20 years. Ms. DiCicco is 57 years old. Your roots have been a very close one to Concord, and I wonder if you could begin by telling us some of your family ties to the community.
Sure. My father actually was born and raised in Concord, and so was I. He and his family lived in the on Belknap Street near the depot, and grew up there. My mother happened at the time that he met her to be living in Lincoln, and they were married, and they built a house on Fairhaven Road in Concord, and that's where I grew up, actually. So I had the experience of visiting the Belknap area where my grandmother lived at the time, growing up on Fairhaven Road, and actually through the course of growing up, seeing all of the development that took place on Fairhaven Road, Southfield, Riverdale area, which was all new at the time.
And at your grandparents' house, people would talk about that there was a cattle show at one time on Elsinore.
That's right, at the end of Elsinore Street, and at that time the end of Belknap Street, because they both ended up at the same place. This was before they connected Elsinore and made the round circle. There was a thing called the cattle show, and I can remember my father and my aunts and uncles at the time talking about it, because their home wasn't that far from that end of Belknap Street, and apparently it was a place of fun activity at the time. We used to walk there when I was a child. I think they weren't doing the cattle anymore at that point, mm-hmm. and we'd walk up and look at the river, mm-hmm. but I can remember their talking about it, and going across the street from my grandmother's house to what we were told was Thoreau's pencil factory, at that time a rather dilapidated house, but it was always a source of great interest and intrigue to us as little children, first to even imagine that somebody actually made pencils, and then to know that it was Henry David Thoreau.
And regardless of somebody's occupation at that time, people had chickens and raised
Oh, absolutely. In fact, my grandmother raised chickens. In fact, that story was always retold to me because as a child I could never understand why my father wouldn't eat chicken or turkey. Mm-hmm. And as it turns out, it was his responsibility, I guess, to kill the chickens when it was time for them to be prepared for eating. But they had chickens. I can remember seeing the chickens in her yard when I was a small kid. Gardens were also something that everybody seemed to have. And my grandmother also had a grape arbor. And it was always fun when the grapes would ripen and we would get together and pick the Concord grapes. My grandfather used to make a wine. I never really had any occasion when I was small to experience it, but I remember on my parents' 25th wedding anniversary, my father removed from the preserve closet in our cellar a bottle of wine that his father had made when they were married and had given them, and it intrigued me that all of the color had now gone to the side of the bottle, and when they poured the wine it was totally white. It wasn't too bad. Some of the other bottles had turned to vinegar by that time. But that was something that they did, and of course the children, my father included, worked on farms in the afternoon, picked asparagus. He talked about delivering vegetables and selling them to various places in town along Main Street. And my grandfather actually worked for the town, and as I understand it, was in charge of the building of Thoreau Street, which impressed me to think that he was with the highway department and I guess the supervisor at the time.
Really? So he was very connected with what was developing. At a time when not many people had cars, you had to do everything on foot, and socialization was kind of around people's homes.
That's right. In fact, I remember that very clearly from growing up on Fairhaven Road. We had a very close-knit neighborhood that went all the way from Route 2, where Fairhaven Road began for us, all the way down to Sudbury Road, and that was the neighborhood. It wasn't just the two or three houses immediately around your own house. I can remember neighborhood children in our yard all the time playing. My mother later told me she was pleased that that was the case because she liked to have the children there and enjoying what was our swing and our sandbox at that time. But the entire neighborhood used to come together in the summer, every summer, for a clam bake. And everyone would bring something, and they would actually steam clams and cook lobsters and have hot dogs and all the rest of that, corn, and play games in the field behind our house that was used by Amendolia at the time to grow different crops, mostly asparagus. I also remember deliveries coming to the house because we didn't have a car. The baker would arrive once a week, and it just seemed that everybody knew when the baker was coming, and so all of us kids would be in the driveway waiting for Rip, that was his name, the Brockelman baker, to back his truck into the driveway, and my mother would come out and the back doors of the truck would open, and we'd all see all of the wonderful food in drawers. I can always remember the drawers in the back of the truck, and my mother would always make sure that she bought something for everybody so that we would have a treat that afternoon, but that was pretty special. The milkman came, and milk was in bottles, and I have vague remembrances of an ice truck that used to go by the house, although we had a refrigerator when I was small. There still was an ice man who came by. So deliveries had to be made. If we needed to go anyplace, we walked, and we weren't that far from the center, so it didn't pose that much of a problem, but I can remember walking to the town library, being introduced to the library by my mother, and spending time there searching through the books and meeting Mrs. Miller, who was the librarian then. But we walked everywhere, even to the center of town, to the stores that were there at the time, so that my mother could do her errands, and then we'd walk back to the house.
So life did focus on family, neighborhood, and also church, parish.
That's right. Church was very important for us. We belonged, and still do, to St. Bernard's Parish. And through the years, it became even more important because by the time I was in junior high, or late elementary junior high, there was talk of actually building a Catholic school here in town. The religious education of the children of the parishioners at St. Bernard's had always taken place at Sunday school, and the lay people had spent their time teaching us. But the prospect of having a Catholic school in town was very exciting for, I would say, all of the members of the church, including the church in West Concord, Our Ladies. And the issue then became, how does Cardinal Cushing, who was the person who was instrumental in bringing that school to town, have the wherewithal to actually build the building. And I can remember discussion of his having negotiated, the cardinal that is, with the woman, I think her name was Mrs. Moses, who lived in the house on the property on Main Street, which subsequently housed the convent, and agreeing with her that she would be able to stay on that property for the rest of her life, and there was an arrangement made whether she donated the land or sold it very inexpensively to the cardinal. But it still meant that money had to be raised, and I can remember my parents and my friends' parents helping to support the building of the school with dinners. The cardinal would come to town and there would be $100 a plate dinners, for example, at Monument Hall. Or there would be fairs, or there would be shows that would be put on, talent kinds of shows, to raise money. And somehow it all happened, the money was raised and the school was built. And I can remember being in the Concord Public Schools and thinking, wouldn't it be nice if I could go to this new school?
Mm-hmm.
And it was because I had asked if I could that by the time I got to high school age, I transferred from the public schools to grade 9 at Rose Hawthorne, which was the name of the school, named after Hawthorne's daughter, who had started a community of sisters to take care of the poor in New York. It, as I look back on it, was interesting to me that I was really the one who was very excited about wanting to go to the school, and as a result of that, my parents supported me and said, great, we'd love to have you do that. And it wasn't out of any disappointment or dissatisfaction with the public schools, but rather it seemed a nice
exciting,
opportunity,
yeah,
and an exciting,
yeah,
opportunity for me. And since I was always too old to enter the elementary school, because they began with kindergarten and added a grade a year, I was always ahead of that curve. My first opportunity was grade 9, and so I entered that school. It wasn't soon after that that talk of beginning a school for boys, because the Rose Hawthorne was just for girls, came, and Xavier was the school that was then built again by the Cardinal.
Was that after you had already graduated Rose Hawthorne, or during that time?
I think it was during that time that that, mm-hmm, school was being built, and it was really after I had graduated that it was really in,
mm-hmm,
operation.
You graduated in 59?
That's correct. Mm-hmm. Graduated in 59, went on to Regis College in Weston.
So you were one of the first graduating.
Actually,
classes.
That's right. I was in the third graduating class. There were 24 members of that class.
24 girls.
So we were a very small high school.
Yeah, well, that was quite a achievement, and I'm sure you looked at that and, among the Catholic population here. Can you describe the mixing between Catholics and Protestants?
Today, it almost seems amusing to,
mm-hmm,
me, actually, but I can remember growing up and being told that it was not right for us to associate, us being the Catholics, to associate with the Protestants, and one of the worst things we could ever do would be to attend any of their religious services or even step inside their churches. Now, I don't know what in the world,
mm-hmm,
was supposed to happen to us, but I can remember very early on, this is when I was really small, hearing from one of the parish priests, no, we don't associate, we find Catholic friends. As I grew older, it seemed that that mindset was changing, and we had, I think, in our parish, an absolutely wonderful person, Pastor Monsignor York, who was very friendly with Reverend Greeley. And I know that they established some very strong bonds, and it was those kinds of links that really changed a lot of the old thinking. And very soon, it wasn't the wrong thing to do, and the whole tenor of the community changed, I think, because people were no longer worrying about what will happen to me if I do this,
mm-hmm,
and even not being able to imagine what that would be. But it was interesting. Now that I think back on it, I can remember, well, my mother even told me stories about her childhood and being told that she couldn't be a member of the Girl Scouts because that was a Protestant organization. When I was growing up, I don't know how much that had changed, but I was a Girl Scout with my mother's blessing and assistance. So things were even changing then. But when you stop and think about it, it really isn't that many years ago.
Mm.
I think we've come a long way in a very short time.
Mm, we certainly have. So that it was focused more on the dogma or teaching of the church rather than emanating from individual homes?
Well, mm-hmm, actually, I don't even know whether it was dogma of the church, but it was certainly coming from church leaders. mm-hmm. and the faithful listened to what they had to say.
I
think there were many who couldn't quite understand that point, and I had many non-Catholic friends in school, and I can remember going to their homes, talking about their church, and it didn't seem to be a huge problem, and certainly my parents weren't thinking that I was going to meet my demise if I had non-Catholic friends. But for some people, I think it was a huge concern. And luckily, as time went on, attitudes changed, and I think people became a lot more realistic about what's appropriate and what isn't.
There was some rivalry, contained but real, between the Irish and Catholic?
My understanding is...
Of the Irish and
the
Italian.
Italians,
yeah, yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. It's my understanding, in my father's childhood, that there were rivalries. In fact, in the neighborhood where he grew up, there was an Irish population and Italian population, and I guess at times they even came to blows. The way they're described, I think, is a lot more dramatic, perhaps, than what
mm-hmm.
actually happened. And yet it might resemble what some might think of gang fights, but it never was at that level, so it's hard to characterize it, but some of the Irish guys, I guess, would be giving the Italian guys some trouble, and I remember a story that my father told me about a cousin of his who had just arrived from Italy, who I guess was pretty strong and didn't speak English very well, was just learning the language, and they used to say to him, "Go get them." And he was just so imposing that he scared them. I don't think he ever physically did anything to anybody, but they used to talk about, probably it's almost like neighborhood turf kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
By the time they had grown up, and by the time I was growing up, that kind of thing had also vanished too, and people used to joke about what used to happen when they were kids.
As a teenager, your social life also was geared around parish life, the Catholic youth organization.
That's right. With my friends at school, of course, and also family. But we had a small group of young people at that time, we were probably in our late teens, who gathered together, and we formed a group of our own. There were only about 8 or 10 of us in the group. And we used to meet at Monument Hall, and in the bottom floor of Monument Hall are the Knights of Columbus quarters. They had a pool table at the time, and we thought that was pretty special. So we used to hold our meetings there so that we could play pool with each other,
mm-hmm.
and travel off to go to the movies, which was a huge thing to think that at our age, now this is our late teens, that we would actually get in a car together and drive out of town to the movies, which is so taken for granted by kids today, or drive off. I think probably one of the biggest things we ever did was drive off to someplace on Route 1, which seemed miles and hours away from home, and it was probably only about 45 minutes at the time, to a drive-in restaurant, because Arne Ginsberg, who happened to be a radio personality at the time, was advertising that that's where we should go and get a hamburger or something, and if you said the right thing, you'd get a free meal. And we thought that was great fun, and that was our big night out to see if it actually worked, which it did, by the way. But that was the kind of thing that we did.
Movies were more likely to be in Maynard?
Yes, actually, the movie theater was in Maynard. I remember we had a bowling alley, but I can remember being told that the town of Concord did not want a movie theater, that was not something that this town would have. I do remember, however, when we were small, growing up, that 51 Walden used to be called the Veterans Building when I was a kid. And every Saturday morning, somebody had movies for the kids, and we used to go there on Saturday morning and sit in these wooden folding chairs and watch the cartoons, and maybe an Abbott and Costello movie, and have candy that we could buy at the little counter at the front of the Veterans Building. Those were the only movies that this town, I think, actually ever had. But it, for entertainment, even then, you needed to leave Concord.
Mm-hmm.
But the Fine Arts Theater, and there was another one, there were two theaters in Maynard, now it's just Fine Arts.
Your mother had worked, before she settled down with the family, had worked for various families in Concord.
That's right. Actually, she had lived with a number of families through her youth, having been an orphan, actually, and a ward of the state from the time that she was a very small child. And so her life was one of living with different families. When she became of high school age, she was living with a family in Lincoln and used to work for a family in Concord. Actually, the former chief of police mother had her work there, and I believe it was on the weekends that she would work there, and then she would go back to the place that she was living in Lincoln during the week while she was at Concord High School. She also worked...
Who was the 12th?
That was Chief Ryan.
I see.
And she also worked for David Little's parents.
Mm-hmm.
So she knew Mr. and Mrs. Little. In fact, it was they who actually gave her wedding reception when she was married.
Mm-hmm.
So she worked there and I think was doing most of the cooking eventually. And then after she was married, she would go there to help with special parties that they would have. But they had a wonderful, special relationship, and she had a very special regard for both Mr. and Mrs. Little and David Little, who I think was an usher at her wedding, actually. So she always talks with great fondness of that family.
So she worked for David's father.
That's
and
correct.
Harry and Miriam.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
And mostly she was cooking.
She was cooking. She was waiting table,
mm-hmm.
doing general kinds of things like that.
And your father's work?
My father, as I said, grew up in Concord. He apparently met Walter Shaw, who at that time owned the Walter K. Shaw Cotton Company. And he went to work for him and actually worked his way from a beginning level there, actually, to vice president of the company by the time he retired. And he had worked there for, I think it was over 50 years, actually. But he learned the cotton business, actually, by beginning to work at the company, because he hadn't gone to any cotton school, and I don't know whether there ever was such a thing. But he did become a recognized classer of cotton. There's a way that you can pull the cotton between your fingers and tell what the staple of the cotton is, and I guess that's important in terms of what you would make then with the cotton and how strong it would be for a cloth. And after having worked there for quite a while, actually was called in by the government often. He had to fly to Washington to settle disputes that plantation owners would have with the mills who were arguing over whether they had gotten the right staple cotton. And toward the end of his career there, actually ended up with Gordon Shaw traveling to Saudi Arabia because they had a huge cotton deal that they needed to attend to there. So he did a lot of traveling, and my mother went with him. This is when I was now in late high school and college, and they would find themselves traveling just about every year to England, to English Sewing, which was in Manchester, having to meet with the owners and the head buyers there.
Mm-hmm.
So they had an opportunity as a result to do a lot of traveling in Europe.
And that was a cotton brokerage.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. After your own education, you came to Concord Carlisle High School, first as a French teacher.
That's right. I had gone through college and I had taught for 3 years in Uxbridge, Massachusetts,
mm-hmm.
and came back here as a French teacher in 1967. So much enjoyed working with the faculty and the students here. In 1974, the superintendent of schools at that point asked me if I would be interested in leaving the classroom for 1 year.
Who was
this? Was Ralph Sloan.
Mm-hmm.
If I would leave for 1 year and supervise the implementation of Chapter 766, which by now everybody recognizes as the big special education law in the state, I had been spending the past year, the previous year, 73-74, working with the Massachusetts Teachers Association in actually developing information materials about the law. So I said, sure, I'd be interested in doing that. And I left the classroom in 1974 with the intention of returning in 1975. But actually, I haven't been back on a full-time basis since then. After a stint doing that, I was asked by Ralph again, would I please step in and replace the personnel director who had just resigned to take another job. I did that for a while with the promise that at the end of that particular assignment, I would be back in the classroom. And it was at near the end of that assignment that he approached me again and said, how about going to the high school as principal? And so in January of 1978, I found myself here in these offices, actually, meeting with the two vice principals at the time, Frank Cripple and Hal Manley, talking about what do I need to be aware of as I step into this position. And as you can see, I never left that position. Although a couple of times since then, I have had the opportunity to teach a French class. So it hasn't totally been gone. 2 years ago, I taught a class for the full year and really enjoyed that.
That's very nice. Going to back up to Chapter 766, and I would like your observation of its effectiveness, its costs, its challenges.
It was a law that had to be lobbied very strongly in the beginning. Back in the early 70s, people had clearly become aware of the fact that students who had learning disabilities, and in particular students, young people who were developmentally delayed, emotionally disturbed, had been really put away in either institutions or if they were in schools, even students who were having difficulty reading, who later became diagnosed as having dyslexia, for example, weren't being served well and were being served in less than adequate environment, a closet in a school where somebody could tutor a student, or in the hallway, or maybe not at all. So the parents of these children, in particular strong lobby from the parents of retarded children, lobbied for 766, which was supposed to bring the children with disabilities and needs to a position of being able to receive a decent education. The law, as it was constructed, I think, had the right intention, and it was forward-thinking. It was the first in the nation to be developed, and Massachusetts really stood in the forefront. In fact, the national legislation was based on Massachusetts. In the early years, there were a lot of questions about what the law actually meant, and there were questions in particular about private placements. A number of special education schools were in the process of being developed, and many of them were claiming that they could provide the education that the public schools could not. And since there was a law that stipulated that certain services had to be provided for students, they wanted the parents to know that they were ready to do it, and the public schools really didn't know what they were doing. It happened that Concord had had special education services for years before the law ever was enacted, and the teachers and the tutors had been working really hard with students. They were aware of the impending legislation, and they were developing educational plans. When I entered that office in 74, we already had challenges from a number of parents who had students who were in private schools, who wanted their children to remain in those private schools, were reluctant to bring them back to public school. I can, on the one hand, understand why that would be, because the programs really weren't that well known to them. By the same token, we wanted them back in the public schools because now we were responsible as a school system for paying the tuitions. We felt we could serve them. And we spent the first few months, actually, not only being sure that we were developing the right kinds of plans for the kids we had in the school, but working in a very adversarial manner, in many cases, to bring students back to the school. As that law has been implemented over the years, there have on occasion, I think, been abuses that have occurred because interpretations have been extended far beyond what the drafters of that legislation ever intended. For example, I can remember within the first couple of years people demanding that eyeglasses be paid for by the school system for a student, and it took a great deal of effort to be able to clarify that that was not the intent of the law. There are still issues that arise. Massachusetts still has the most open and all-encompassing special education law. In fact, it goes beyond what the federal law does now, and there are still questions about interpretation on some fronts. But I do strongly believe, guarantee, that across the board, students with learning needs, learning disabilities, would have been well served. So I would never want to say that we shouldn't have passed that legislation. What we need now are clearer definitions of exactly what the intent of the law is, because it has become a very costly piece of legislation to implement. And in fact, what some people predicted early on in terms of the funding having by law to go to special education eventually affecting regular education is coming to pass in a number of school systems. And certainly in our own school system, we can see growing costs. We know we have to spend the money there, and sometimes we end up shaving and cutting in regular education so that we're sure that we have the money there. But we need to find a way to be able to continue to implement that law without pitting regular and special education against each other, because we need to be doing right by all of our students.
And probably you have found yourself trying to negotiate costs.
We have. Another good thing I think that's come out of it is that we actually look not only at special education students, but all our regular education students, in terms of what kinds of modifications or adaptations do we need to make. And we've now come to the point of wanting to be able to determine what can we do in the regular education classroom to be able to serve student X so that that student doesn't have to become labeled as a special education student. And actually, the people who designed the legislation from the beginning had always intended that students might get special services under Chapter 766, but the intent was to get them out of that umbrella and back into the mainstream as much as possible without having to have this umbrella of special education. So I think we're trying, at least here, and I know a number of other school systems are, to take a look at the students on an individual basis in terms of their needs in the regular mainstream.
Now, when you became principal, you're seeing the school from a very different perspective. In the late 60s, early 70s, there were all sorts of experimentations that probably made the atmosphere a bit looser, less...
I guess you could call it that. That's a good characterization. It was. I can remember arriving here when I was about to become principal and having a whole different outlook. In 67, when I came as a teacher, it seemed that a lot of my attention was really focused in the classroom, and in the area that was known as Foreign Language Department. So I really wasn't as aware of the entire school. During that period of time, however, I obviously worked with other departments and was able, through committees that I worked on, to have some kind of a feel for the rest of the school. But it was never the same as it would be, first of all, when I became president of the Teachers Association and was then responsible really to attend to the interests and the concerns of the entire faculty. And then, as I had said, in 78 when I came back as principal, I can remember the first few days when I returned in 1978, speaking with the vice principals at the time and having them say to me, well, this is what you need to be concerned about. Those students you need to be concerned about. And looking around at the school and what I felt was a lot of commotion and hustle and bustle in the hallways, we had open campus, we still do as a matter of fact, but it seemed that students were everywhere. And for some reason, they weren't all necessarily getting along with each other either. And it just seemed that the discipline code was being implemented all the time. It was a very cumbersome and complicated discipline code. I couldn't understand how anybody kept track of it, because it was the first time you do X, you suffer this penalty, the second time it's this, the third time it's that, and it seemed to me to be horrendous record keeping. At any rate, it seemed to me at the time that one of the first things that needed to be done was to put more structure within the school, or at least have a sense that it wasn't always in commotion. And at the same time, I knew that at that point, the involvement of our parents was not as great. In fact, the teachers were very reluctant to meet with the parents, feeling that they were really trying to criticize and find fault with what they were doing, and the parents were very concerned that the teachers weren't really doing their job the way they thought it should be done, and there was miscommunication all over the place. So my initial goals, if you will, really focused around the climate in the school and the relationship among parents and faculty and school personnel, and really trying to open the school to the community, because I really had the sense that it seemed to be closed, and also trying to engage students and to establish a different kind of way to operate in the school. And I would think if we took a day back then and compared it to a day now, I think it's pretty much changed. Of course, other things have changed as well. The state has passed a law that there shall be no smoking on school grounds. I can remember even back in 1967, early 70s, smoke all over the place, not in the building but outside, and courtyards that were so messy with cigarette butts, and times when we really wondered whether they were just cigarettes or not also marijuana. Today, I think we have a school that still has a great deal of personal freedom in it, where students are able to demonstrate their responsibility and move around the building when they need to, but that doesn't have the sense of out of control that it seemed to have then, where faculty and parents are working hand in hand, where I think the school is really open to the community and we have people from the community who are here working with us. It's a whole different atmosphere. Not that we're perfect every single day, but I think it's changed. Perhaps also mirrors a change in just societal attitudes. Back then, there was more of a feeling that I send my child to the school, you're the teacher, you take care of my kid, and whatever you say is fine, to I'd really like to be involved in my child's education, and I really do believe that when you say I'm a partner with you in education, that I am. And I like that kind of an approach a lot better, too.
How have students changed today?
Oh, I think students, I keep telling people adolescents will be adolescents will be adolescents, but I really think that students are faced with many, many more pressures, many, many more temptations, if I can qualify them as that, than certainly than I was, and certainly, I believe, than students were back 20, 30 years ago. There's almost an unwritten rule that everybody has to be number one, and everybody has to go to the best college in the United States, and everybody has to get an A, and everybody has to wear the right thing and be the best. And it's not just Concord-Carlisle High School, it's what we see all around us. And that troubles me a lot, because I think that that kind of pressure to be the best and not to be able to fail and not to be able to have even one fault makes it very difficult for students. At the same time, they see the media, they go to movies, everything around them says that experimentation in all kinds of things, which are very risky for them, whether it be alcohol or drugs or even sexual activity, is okay. And if you can handle it, you can handle it, and that's fine. And I think sometimes we have to stop and recognize that our young people are not small adults, and that there is a level of responsibility that is appropriate for them, but we can't expect them to be the mothers and the fathers and the statesmen and the governors, and they need time to grow up.
Yeah.
And sometimes I think we just allow too much to be placed on them, and we allow them to place too much stress on themselves. So we keep working to find ways around that.
Well, certainly you have achieved a great deal, and it is not insignificant for us to comment that you have been a woman educator.
That also actually was something that struck me when I was first appointed. I had never really, to be very honest, given that much thought at all. When I was teaching in the classroom, it never seemed strange to me that anybody would decide anything on a gender basis, and I guess that was my own naivete at the time. The administration in the Concord Public Schools had always included women. There had been women principals at the junior high then. We didn't have a school we called middle school. Certainly elementary schools had women principals. Central office had women assistant superintendents. The director of student support services was a woman. The director of personnel was a woman. And so for the superintendent to suggest that maybe I would like to be the high school principal never struck me as, oh my goodness, I'm a woman and here I am being offered a principalship. It wasn't probably but about 2 weeks after I was here in this office that I was approached by the town paper, the Concord Journal, which was doing an article, and they were the ones who said, and how does it feel to be a woman principal? And I was really taken back by that, and I can remember saying something like, I really haven't given that any thought, and actually I would assume that I've been asked to do this job because the superintendent feels I have the qualifications to do the job. And from that point on, I thought about all of that. I eventually found out, I guess, I was the second woman in the state to become a high school principal.
And the first.
In the first here in Concord. It's never seemed, however, some kind of huge special thing. I mm-hmm. still look at it as I really hope that I've demonstrated that I have the ability and the qualifications to do the job, and I think that that's really what the superintendent at the time was looking at. And I think that this school system, this community, is special in that way because I have not recognized any kind of discrimination women are less than men or can't do the same kind of a job. Never in my whole growing up in this community did I ever sense that as an attitude or a practice. And I think that's something special for what I experienced, that it would seem to be a strange thing to me to be some huge achievement. But in this position, and having met with colleagues and traveling outside of my little small cocoon of Concord, it becomes very clear that all places aren't like this community, never were, and the people that I've had the privilege of knowing and growing up with don't exist everywhere.
And that's why we're making note of it, that it is a achievement. Anything else?
No.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.